So what, would you please help me welcome our speaker tonight? It is Al B. from Mollica Hill in New Jersey. Did I get that right? Mollica Hill. My bad.
I like Mollica better, though.
His home group's the other 12.
Sorry, dude. My name's Al. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. From Mollica Hill. I like that. Mollica Hill. Awesome, man. Wait till I got back and tell them where they live at, Mollica Hill. Whew. First of all, thank you so much for the opportunity to be in service. I'm nervous as hell, too. I mean, it's going to take a few minutes for God to shake the self out of me. I had a long talk with God today. And during that talk, myself and God knew exactly what I was going to speak about tonight. As I stand before you tonight, only God knows what the hell I'm going to talk about. So bear with me. Let me go through the usual stuff while I'm trying to get focused here. My anniversary date's July 4th, 1983. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I've had the same sponsor for over 3 decades. That's just a beautiful gift. The gift that's more profound than that, that holds more beauty for me, and holds more grace for me, and holds more power for me than that, is that I have a sponsor that had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. I stumbled into a man that was God-driven, God-conscious, understood the depth and the weight upon a condition of which he suffered from, and was armed with the facts. Had found enough love in his heart to take another person through this beautiful 12-step process. That's significant to me. Significant. As I talk tonight, that significance may be reflected, if God wants that today. I don't know how to turn it up. Folks back there are saying they can't hear me, so if you guys can do something for that, that's cool. There, what a concept, eh? I'm a little slow, but I'm not standing still, all right? I got a campaign going on in New Jersey. I think it's an honor to stand at the podium, and it's become tradition around our way to do just what I've done, talk about anniversary date, sponsor, that kind of good stuff. But the campaign I have going on in New Jersey is that if we're given the honor and the privilege to step up to this microphone, that I should be required to tell you the last time I heard a fifth step. I believe that if I'm given the honor to step up to this microphone to be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous, that I should be required to tell you the last time I received a phone call from someone I'm working with who's getting ready to embark on the ninth step amends process. You see, folks I work with, I ask them if they remember to call me before they embark on that process, just so we can remind each other that it's not about us, it's about God. And just so we can remind each other that we've created enough destruction and harm as a result of this disease, and we don't create any more. So if you'd like to join me in that campaign, start talking about it here. I was given the honor and privilege to hear a fifth step yesterday morning. At a park down by where I live, Audubon Park, got a nice stream that kind of weaves itself through a lot of oak trees, which I affectionately and very honorably call Freedom Stream. A lot of men started their journey into freedom at that, and for me to have been given the honor and the privilege to be present with those folks and a God of our understanding. It just blows me away. All right. Where do I start? Hopefully tonight I'm going to talk about perception. I'm going to talk about power. I'm going to talk about principles. And ultimately I hope I'm going to talk about purpose. My first drink was at age 10. Now before I get into that, I could stand up here and I could tell you a story of childhood abuse and trauma. Not why I'm an alcoholic. I could tell you a story about in and out of various institutions through my journey. Not why I'm an alcoholic. What I will share with you though is my first drink. I was age 10. Was drinking with some older guys. Went out, drank, got drunk, got beat up, urinated in my pants. They drug me home, threw me on my parents' front lawn. I came to the next morning, and my first thought was, I can't wait to do that again, man. Now, that's not everyone's story. That just happens to be mine. I know folks that drank successfully for years, and they're as much alcoholic as I am today. I say that to say that I didn't understand it then, but what I understand today is I suffered from the phenomenon of craving from drink number one. The buffer was never there for me. I would spend the next 16 years of my life looking for that sense of ease and comfort that I found from that first drink. Alcohol did for me exactly what the book says. That sense of ease and comfort came. And I wasn't able to differentiate the true from the false after a little bit. My alcoholic life became the only normal one. And that was actually more focused than what was happening in my life prior to that. I believed that alcohol was my solution, and had I not found alcohol at age 10, I probably would have capped myself way before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes I start my story with my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was 1979. Mom, dad, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, neighbors, cats, dogs, all had a desire for me to stop drinking. Problem was, I didn't have a desire. See, I talked a little bit about perception, and my perception was that if you went through what I went through, you would drink too. Perception's an interesting thing. The power of Alcoholics Anonymous has altered my perception. Now, let me tell you, so there was a young boy, 8 years old, and he took his baseball bat, and he took his ball, and he went out into his backyard. And he took his ball, and he threw it up in the air, and he said, I'm the best hitter in the world. And he swung, and he missed it. Well, he kind of stood there, and perseverance, one of our principles, he picked that ball back up, threw it up in the air, said, I'm the best hitter in the world. He swung, and he missed it. So now he's kind of scratching his head and thinking, all right. Picks that ball up, throws it up in the air. He swings and he misses it. He says, you know what? I'm the best pitcher in the world. That's kind of what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I was the best hoodlum in the world, and what I found out and what I get accused of sometimes today is being a gentleman. So 1979, an introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a Friday night meeting, and what I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous at that time was from some folks that I ran with, and they said, it's pretty wild. You usually go down a church basement with a bunch of gray-haired old guys, and they put a bottle right in the middle of the table. And they said the first one that reaches for the bottle, they smack the shit out of, right? So this is my perception of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm getting ready to get incarcerated again, and I got to go to this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. So I go into this meeting. Now, bear with me. If I knew I was going to be held accountable someday to tell my story, like I would have took notes or some kind of stuff, you know. I said for a lot of years when I came back that I went to that meeting and I kicked that door in. Well, that door opens out. So some of the things I remember happening most vividly in my story never happened. And some of the things I don't have a clue about, I've got green sheets to say that I've done this and I've done that. And so I went into this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the first thing I recall is getting hit with a big cloud of smoke. Back then, they used to let the smoke in the meetings. Then I remember some idiot pretending like he was happy, and he had a big fake plastic smile on his face, and he come walking up to me with that big smile, Kenny M. And he looks at me, and he eyes me up from ankles to shoulders. Now, he was a pretty observant guy because the next words that came out of his mouth were pretty classic. He says, "Is this your first meeting?" Now, I may or may not have urinated in my pants that day. I may or may not have bathed that week. I don't know about you, but when I'm drinking, that's all I can do is drink. It's all I can do is drink. So he assessed that it was my first meeting, and he invites me in, and he puts his hand out, and I look at him with them Charles Manson eyes, and I'm thinking to myself, and the horse you rode in on too, pal. And he sits me down at a table, and I'm scoping the place out, and there's white styrofoam cups all over the place. Now I'm thinking, man, they put the bottle out already, and I miss it. I'm not even going to get a drink out of the deal. Then I see him come walking up to me with a cup, and I'm thinking, maybe he's really not an idiot. And that wasn't what I'm thinking, but since I'm on tape, I'll say I was an idiot. And he brings his cup up to me, and he sets it down. And I look at it, and I see it's coffee. And I thought, that's not good. And then I seen it was halfway full. And I thought, he's cheap, too. Not only is he an idiot, but he's a cheap idiot. I say that because folks in Alcoholics Anonymous knew more about me than I knew about myself then. He knew I was going to spill that coffee, and I spilt that coffee. And that meeting started, and at that time they used to start at one end of the room, and everybody was sharing go around. And I'm sitting there kind of in that fog, you know, and they get to me. And I used to say I stood up with all the courage that I had. Tonight I know I stood up with all the self-centered fear that was ruling my life. I stood up at that meeting and I said, listen, you stay bop a bop a bop a bop a bop away from me, and I'll stay bop a bop a bop a bop away from you. Well, that whole room got dead silent. Dead silent. Probably for about 4 seconds, but you know when you're in that alcoholic haze and you don't know whether it's 4 seconds, 4 hours, 4 days. I mean, for me, the cesspool of alcoholism just flowed continuously, and I couldn't differentiate the true from the false or any other damn thing that was happening in my life. That room got dead silent, and then I heard, keep coming back. I thought that was some funny stuff, man, when they said keep coming back, because at that stage of my life, I wasn't hearing keep coming back. I was hearing get the hell out and don't come back. Significant thing happened. I ran into a guy, Frank C. Now, Frank was sober about 13, 14 years at that time. And Frank, with the wisdom of someone with that amount of time that had been working some of our principles, looked at me with that sideways smile, kind of almost giggling, but not giggling. And he handed me his phone number, and he said, Al, if you ever do want to stop drinking, here's my number. Well, I would call Frank 3 or 4 times over the next 4 years, and I would call him, and I would run, and I would call him, and I would run, and I would call him, and I would run. See, I would hit that point of desperation and make that phone call, and very rapidly self would return. Over that 4 years, I developed the most intimate relationship with the hideous four horsemen. I developed an intimate relationship with terror. I developed an intimate relationship with bewilderment. I developed an intimate relationship with frustration. And ultimately, I developed an intimate relationship with despair. My drinking would lead me to foam rubber on the 6th floor of the county jail in Camden, detoxing. I would be begging God, who I didn't know who God was, not to let me drink. And I would get released on OR, and I would walk right across the street to a bar called Bruno's. And as I'm walking across the street, I'm begging God not to let me drink. and I would drink. September 16th, 1979, my 19-year-old brother, on his 19th birthday, got killed in a motorcycle accident. His girl in the back got killed, and the dude that hit him in the car got killed. I ran back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Ran back. Not with a desire not to drink. With a desire to tell you people to take your God and shove it. So that intimate relationship found its way to me calling Frank on July 4th, 1983. He picked me up out of the street. By this time, I knew what it was like to be homeless. I like to call homeless by choice. See, people started putting guidelines on me, like, you can stay here, but you can't drink. That's not a choice. That's not a choice for me. Can such a person quit on a non-spiritual basis? I don't know. I didn't have choices in my life at that time. So July 4th, 1983, I wind up in 1555 Haddon Avenue. It's in the heart of Camden. It was a detox back then. Not a nice place, not in a nice neighborhood. I came to and I thought I was at the Taj Mahal, man. And he would take me away to some place and bring me back to that Belmar meeting. When I came back to that Belmar meeting and walked into that meeting, who's the first guy you think I seen? Kenny M. He still had that plastic smile on his face, pretending like he was happy. He looked and seen me, and that smile went off his face, and he came walking up to me with that look on his face, saying, you know what, we're not playing your games again. And as he got close to me, now at this stage of my life, I was 26 years old, I couldn't read, couldn't write, didn't have a pot to piss in, a window to throw it out of, couldn't stay out of jail, couldn't stop abusing me and every human being I came in contact with. I've been separated from alcohol for a period of time in the place I was, and I was scared to death and not knowing I was scared to death. I was driven by that self-centered fear, the 100 forms of fear, self-pity, self-delusion, self-seeking that we suffer from, and I was running wild, man. And he came up to me and Kenny said two significant things. He looked me dead in the eye and said, Al, I figured if your dumb ass didn't die, you'd be back through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he said, welcome home. Found a home here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found a home where I didn't have to measure my words or consider my thoughts. You see, I believe home today is where the tears of the heart can dry at their own pace. You people began to taught me, to teach me, that those tears of the heart truly can dry. You began to teach me that my eyeballs are the windows to my soul, and that those tears help to clean them, so I get a better look at who I am, what I am, and where I need to go. I believe today that had the eyes no tears, the soul would have no rainbow. I told Alan I wasn't going to talk about rainbows tonight. I lied. Sorry, Alan. But I would start making meetings, 2 and 3 meetings a day. I did that for 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks. I'm not really sure. And I really started getting worried. Because I'm in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous making 2 to 3 meetings a day, and I'm watching you people. And I'm watching smiles. And I'm looking at what appeared to be freedom. And my head was getting worse. When I come in, it was like 6 TV sets all on different channels, right? After about 3 weeks of making three meetings a day, it was like 10 TV sets on different channels. And the volume was jacked up, man. And I started to believe that I was broken beyond repair. I started to believe that Alcoholics Anonymous won't work for me. And I heard this thing called sponsorship. Now my thinking was, I'm going to try this thing called sponsorship, and when it don't work, I'm just going to go blow my brains out. Because I couldn't, I knew where I was. I was physically absent enough to know where I was. And I wasn't going back to where I was at any cost. There's no doubt in my mind at that time in my life I would have made this supreme sacrifice. There's no doubt in my mind. Now, I'm a convicted felon. The other 12, by the way, my home group is a traditions meeting. That's what my life's been reduced to in Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group's a traditions meeting. So if you do the math, I'm 57 years old today. I picked up at 10, do the math. You know what was going on at that time around there. So I love our traditions. I like the link 1, 3, 5, and 10. The linkage of those four traditions teaches me etiquette in Alcoholics Anonymous. So my story will be about alcohol tonight, but if you take a good look at my hair, it's got that beautiful methamphetamine gray in it. And that was my answer for a little while. But anyway, I'm getting ready to blow my brains out. I figured, let me try this sponsorship thing. Now, I'm a convicted felon. My sponsor's a retired Camden cop. Beautiful, ain't it? Only in Alcoholics Anonymous, man, I'm telling you. I didn't know he was a cop when I asked him, or I would have never asked him, man. Trust me, I was still hiding, man. So I go up to him, I ask him to be my sponsor. Oh, my God. You talk about a gift. He said, yeah. Within about 3.5-4 hours, I had a pencil in my hand. That man did for me what institutions couldn't do through that 16-year journey through alcoholism. That man and you people did for me what a lot of folks couldn't do. I was delivered a message that maybe was around, but I never heard before. And that message was delivered to me in a language that was foreign to me at that time. I was delivered a message of self-honesty. I was delivered a message of hope. I was delivered a message of faith. I was delivered a message of courage. I was delivered a message of integrity. That man delivered me a message of willingness, a message of humility, a message of justice and brotherly love. He delivered me a message of good judgment and self-discipline. He delivered a message of perseverance. He delivered a message of awareness and belief. And ultimately, when that man placed my hand in God's hand, he delivered a message of love and a message of service. You see, I thought I was the labels that I picked up through my journey in alcoholism. I thought I was what society said I was. And one of my favorite ones was incorrigible. Ain't that cool? I didn't even know what it was, but it sounded pretty tough, so I figured that's me. It's the only thing I believed that the judge said was when he told me that I was incorrigible. And what I learned is that I wasn't incorrigible. I learned that I wasn't antisocial. I learned that I had a physical allergy and a mental obsession. I learned that I suffered from this thing called phenomenon of craving. I learned that selfishness and self-centeredness was the root of my problem, and I learned that lack of power was my dilemma. And ultimately what I learned from that man is that I suffer from a spiritual malady. And when he identified a malady as a desperate condition and the spirit as the guiding principle in my life, It made sense, man. You see, I never fit anywhere, man. In my head, I never fit anywhere. And he would help me to understand what powerlessness was. You see, I thought powerlessness was when I racked cars up, when I got locked up, when I wound up in handcuffs, when I detoxed on the floor of the jail, when I'm in 4-point restraints in a hospital begging a nurse to sit on my face. And we wonder why the medical profession thinks we're impolite, you know? I'm bleeding to death and I'm concerned about the nurse, you know? It's a disease of perception. So I began to think that my first step experience was acknowledging powerlessness and connecting it to that. My true first step experience was when I learned to fully concede to my innermost self that I was doomed and hopeless. Bill places some pretty significant words in certain parts of that book, and so does Dr. Silkworth. When I truly believed in the innermost part of my heart and soul that I was doomed and I was hopeless, whether I never, ever, 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 and just in case I didn't say ever enough, unless I never, ever touch a drop of alcohol again. Because ultimately what I found out was the disease centers in my mind. And when that hit my heart, it became a lot easier for me to put the embarrassment aside, hit my knees, and do that third step prayer with my sponsor, man. I got a tiny, tiny glimpse of hope. And a tiny, tiny glimpse of faith. The self-honesty from one, the hope from two, and the faith from three. But you know what that pain in the ass sponsor of mine did next? He opened up that blue book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And he read me a piece from there about the decision that I had just made to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And it says, though that decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little, like I think little means like not a lot, could have little permanent effect unless at once. I don't want to hear at once. I just did 3 steps, man. Give me a break. Unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things within us that block us. And that pain in the butt hands me a pencil. And we got the writing. The self-honesty, the hope, the faith mustered up just enough courage for me to put pencil to paper and do the best I can. My sponsor said, that's all you have to do, Al. He told me he ain't never seen a perfect 4-step and he ain't ever going to see a perfect 4-step. He says, if you sit down and you invite God in and do the best you can at that moment, close it, and then we'll talk about it in the presence of something greater than both of us. And let me tell you, when I did that 5th step, our book talks about the beginning of a spiritual experience and all that great stuff, man. You know what happened to me after that 5th step? I learned what color my sponsor's eyes were. Prior to that, I knew that he shined his shoes a whole hell of a lot, man. But I couldn't tell you what color his eyes were. And I started to get a little glimpse of what integrity truly is, man. And I started to learn the color of the eyes of a lot of my brothers and sisters at that point. And I started to feel different inside, man. Started to feel different. That hopelessness and that sense of doom and like, I know I haven't drank in a while, but I know that I'm going to drink because I'm crazier than hell. Started to leave, man. You see, I didn't know then, but I know now I was becoming under the influence of Alcoholics Anonymous, man. I was starting to experience tapping into something greater than myself, man. Ain't that great? Well, I seen somebody back there go like this, man, and that's what it was like, man. It was like, oh, man, it's so different, but it's awesome, man. I started to get that sense of ease and comfort that I had from that drink, man. And I'm like, this shit's pretty cool, man. And I love her 12 and 12. I love all of her literature. I'm not here to promote one thing or another. I don't believe there's any wrong way to find a power greater than myself. My experience has been the big book, initially. And I love the simplicity of the book. Of course, he opened up. There's two paragraphs for 6 and 7. Man, a paragraph and a prayer. And basically what my sponsor told me is spiritual principle, willingness for 6 and humility for 7. And what I've learned over the years is humility is intertwined between all of our steps, man. Humility is the axe upon which I use to cut the roots of selfishness and self-centeredness, man. And you know what that pain in the ass did after step 7? He opened that blue book up again. And he pointed out a line in there. And it starts out with a word that I didn't like then, but a word that I embrace and cherish today. Now. Now. You know, just like in chapter 3, Gnostics, when I'm doing 2 and 3, and it's talking about perceptions and prejudices and all that type of stuff. He made it simple. He talked about my old ideas. Some of us had tried to onto our old what? Until we let go. And that letting go process was starting. But it says after 7, now. Not tomorrow. Like, if it was left up to me, it's like, okay, let me kick back for a while, go down the shore, and just enjoy this beautiful spiritual experience. Now, we need more action. What I've learned is it's a program of continuous daily action. So you read the line, now we need more action, and here's what really pissed me off. And as pissed off as I was then when he read the next thing I'm going to talk about, I love it today, I cherish it today, and I embrace it today. Now we need more action, without which faith, without works, is dead. I then began to understand what I experienced on the floor of that county jail, detoxing on the foam rubber, begging this thing called God not to let me drink, and he let me drink. I then began to understand what was missing. The action that's required by me. Not perfect action. God, some of the most profound lessons I've learned in here was a result of my defects. 6 and 7. I can see you get it. I'm saying, okay, today I'm going to work on lust. I'd pick the wrong damn defect to work on anyway because it would be driven by self, man. What I learned from 6 and 7 is that I need to be willing. And I need to seek humility. So when he said, now, we need more action, without which faith, without works, is dead. He gave me another pencil. And he said, start working on an 8-step harms list. And for me, that 8-step harms list was a lot bigger than my resentment list. Because you see, I didn't have to resent you to harm you. All I had to do was come in contact with you. And I would do that list and I would embark on the amends process. I've had so many powerful 9-step experiences. It's been awesome. But let me share one with you that's really near to my heart. And it's extended over 3 decades. Probably 29 and a half years ago. Maybe a little bit more. And an 8.5 or 9-year-old stepson. Now, I've raised that kid kind of how I was raised, and I potty trained him the way I was potty trained, like a dog's potty trained. I would stick his nose in his own feces, and I could only do what I knew to do, you know? So I'm doing this 9-step with him, and we sit down, and I'm telling him how I harmed him, and before I got finished, he interrupted me. And he looked me dead in the eye and he said, you know what, I hate you. I can't stand you. I don't care if you don't drink for another 100 years. I wish you'd go die. Thank God for the principles of this program. Thank God for sponsorship. Thank God for principled encounters. Had I not experienced those preceding 8 steps, I'd have punched him right in his mouth because that's the only way I know how to deal with life. Instead, I looked that boy dead in the eyes, and I knew his eyes were blue. And I didn't say nothing, but I nodded my head to validate that boy had every right in the world to feel like that. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and he said, Al, you did what you could do, man. Give the outcome to God. I didn't create more harm in it. July 4th, 2013. My 30th anniversary. I wake up. Before I get out of bed, I ask God to direct my thinking. I do the mechanics of 10 and 11. I get out and I'm going about my day. I ain't up for about a half an hour and I'm getting feared up, man. I do what 10 teaches me to do. I immediately ask God to remove it. Talk to somebody. Hadn't harmed anybody, so I didn't need amends. And I went back into meditation. And I got some direction in meditation to call this boy up again. I call him up and I say, hey, Rick, you got some time today? You mind if I spend a little time with you? And he said, sure. So I drive down to Shore and pick him up. We spent about 6 hours together. My God loves me so much, he gave me the opportunity to do another night step with that man. And he's wrestling with his own demons. He's been in and out of this fellowship. And the guys I work with, and myself included, whenever we do a ninth step, I always ask them to end with two things. Ask that person, is there anything that I missed, to give them an opportunity? And then end it with, what can I do to restore this relationship and continue it? And I asked that man those two questions, and he looked me dead in the eyes with them blue eyes of his. He said, you already did, and I love you. That's freedom. That's home. That's God's grace and God's power. You see, I'm not sober tonight by God's grace. I'm sober tonight by God's grace and God's power. See, lack of power is still my dilemma. If I don't access God's power on a daily basis, the only other option I have is to run on self. And that don't work. So the amends were so powerful for me, a real freeing process. And what I'm going to say now, please, I'm not saying it with any disrespect intended whatsoever. Them first 9 steps cannot and will not keep me free. Cannot and will not. Those beautiful first 9 steps and the associated principles simply get me into the solution. And what a beautiful solution it is. You see, now I began to realize that the spiritual life wasn't a theory. That it started with my feet. You know, I love the name of your group, Feet First, man. I say that to all my guys. Keep your feet moving, man. Keep them moving. And what a design for living. How does a hopeless, doomed, helpless drunk get free, man, and stay free? Action. You see, I told you September 16th, 1979, my 19-year-old brother was killed on his 19th birthday. Girl in the back was killed. Guy that hit him in a car was killed. Let me tell you how much my God loves me. Let me tell you how much the purpose of step 9, to be of maximum service to God and the people about us, means to me. Probably about 3-4 years into recovery, I used to go up to the place I was at, out here in Pennsylvania. Actually, it was out in this area somewhere, I think. And whenever there was a person up there that was from Jersey, they used me as an AA connection. So I'm up there, and they introduced me to this guy, and as soon as I heard his name, I knew it was his brother that killed my brother. My God loves me so much that he gave me the opportunity and the privilege to sponsor that man. Tell me there's not power here. Tell me we're not consumed with power and love here. And all I have to do is get the hell out of the way. Let me tell you how much my God loves me, and let me tell you how many gifts my God has given me. May 26, 1996, my 29-year-old brother was killed on his motorcycle. The girl on the back of his bike was killed. My God loves me so much, and my God gives me so many gifts. He gave me a comparative gift. Because what I didn't tell you, in 1979 when my brother was killed, it took my mother 2 days to track me down to find me. And when she found me, she said, Albert Stevens dead. You know what my thought was? Cool. Now I won't get fired from work. You talk about a hole in the soul. You talk about spiritual bankruptcy. You talk about being lost. You talk about being in a dark, desperate place. I never thought I'd share that with another human being, man. And some old beer belly fat cop from Camden helps a convicted felon to get free, man. That's the grace and the beauty and the power that we're under the influence of right now. Some of the most powerful experiences I've had and exchanges and interconnectedness I've had over the years, not a word was spoken. Not a word. I had to go now with my sponsor to tell my grandmother, because my mother had already died like 8 months before that brother was killed. And when I look at God's plan, she could have never buried another son. So I'm in South Philly on 5th and Wolf Street, going over to my grandmother's house. We just got off the bikes, me and my sponsor's all leathered up. I'm hugging him on the corner, he's hugging me, we're both crying. Going over there to tell my grandmother she's got to bury another grandson. That's how much my God loves me. That's how much the Great Spirit does for me. When they crop up, selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. I got a God that loves me enough that he takes them from me. I got a God that loves me enough that if I do harm someone when I'm feared up, that I've got a design for living to make amends for that. And ultimately, what do we need to do? What's that neat word that comes next? Resolutely. Then I need to resolutely. Don't that sound cool? Resolutely. Turn my thoughts to helping someone else. If I've learned nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous, one thing I've learned is it's not about me, man. Not about me. And the perseverance of step 10, man. Steady persistence to a course of action or purpose. You see, our beautiful book taught me that the main object of that book is to enable me to find something greater than myself to solve my problem. Now, what the hell do I do when my problem's solved? Go out and buy trucks and cars and houses and run around with the women? I don't know. Or do I resolutely turn my thoughts to helping others? They're the questions and the challenges I give myself. So that steady persistence to a course of action or purpose. I learned that purpose is the reason for which something exists. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show precisely, not to tell. To show precisely how we recovered. It's the main purpose of that book. Man. That beautiful book instilled purpose within me. To be of maximum service to God and my brothers and sisters here, God's children, man. And not just in these rooms. Having had that awakening as a result of these steps was an awesome experience. What I've learned and what I truly believe, what I've experienced, is that That was the first awakening of many. See, conscious contact for me is, you know, conscious is awareness through thought and observation. And contact is connectedness, coming together. When I'm aware through thought and observation, and I'm connected with something greater than me, there are rainbows every day, Alan. And when I'm not, I'm driven by self. And I act like an ass in a heartbeat, man. See, I'm still backwards. I got to take my glasses off to see the clock. I love this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. October of 1994, my mother died. Her death wasn't quick like my brother's. It was a long, drawn-out death. And she suffered immensely. But that beautiful woman loved Alcoholics Anonymous. She loved you people. See, she got her son back for 11 or 12 years, whatever it was. There was a time in my mother's life where she had to carry her pocketbook like a football. She didn't have to do that for 11 years. She got to see someone go from being internally shackled to being free. She met my friends. She knows my friends. Some of my woman friends would go over and do her hair while she was dying. My male friends would do what helped me do what she needed done around the house. And she loved the Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'll show you how quick self comes back. She's dying, getting close. The doctor gives her, I don't know, a month or whatever the hell it was. And every fall I would do a motorcycle trip up north. We'd do Pennsylvania, New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, ride the hills, look at God's beautiful picture that he paints, and find a place to sleep and just do it. So they say, my mother's supposed to die at this time, so here self jumps in and I start arranging the dates I'm going to do it and the times I'm going to do it. You know, let's set the lights, the stage, the ballet, the scenery, all that good stuff. Step three talks about. So I go on my trip. Now I was only going, I had one destination. Bill Wilson's house in East Dorset, Vermont, the following Saturday. And one person knew that, my sponsor. So I go do that trip and it was awesome, man. Just awesome. I pull up Bill W.'s house in East Dorset, Vermont. Take my helmet off. Get off the bike. A couple greeters walk over. They say, are you Al B. from New Jersey? I'm like, yeah, baby. Look, they know me all the way up here, man. No ego here, huh? I said, yes. Why would you ask? And he hands me a phone number. He says, you need to call this number. So I call the number. And it's my sister. She says, Al, mommy took a turn for the worse. She's hooked up to some machines. What do you want to do? My God loves me enough. You people support me enough. You people love me enough. That I was able to say, pull the plug. I walked into into the big meeting room in Bill's house, and if you've ever been there, that big, beautiful stone fireplace. And I stood in front of there hugging the person I was with. Tears are flowing down my face. Tears are flowing down her face. They were not those tears of desperation. They were not those endless tears of active alcoholism. They were tears of joy. They were tears of validation. They were tears that cleaned the windows to my soul so I could understand where I was and what was happening in my life. May you find him when? I was able to find him then. I was present. I knew in my heart at that moment that my God loved me so much he put me exactly where I needed to be. At Bill W.'s house. And I know that my God, my mother's God, loved her enough to put her exactly where she needed to be. I love this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I just absolutely love it. I'm in a meeting one day and I hear a woman share. Never seen this woman again. She said one line that altered my journey here. She said that love was the ability to gently lead someone back to themselves. You see, deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. I was looking all over the place to find that, not realizing that it was within. It says sometimes it's obscured by pomp, by calamity, by worship of other things. All the crazy shit I do when I'm running on self. When that's removed and I'm connected, I'm free. Free. See, I know what it's like to have the physical shackles on. But more importantly than that, I know what it's like to have my soul shackled and my spirit shackled. And to be so dead that a brother's killed and I can't even acknowledge that on any level other than physical. Takes me a while to get started. Takes me a while to stop. I never know how to stop. Kind of like my drinking. But whether such a person can quit on a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. I've lost that power. You people have given me a design for living to access that power on a daily basis. And that is truly a precious, precious gift. An extremely precious gift. My mother's last words to me. She looked me dead in the eye. And her eyes were peaceful. Contrary to my father's, when I looked in his eyes before he died, he was still feared up, man. But my mother looked me dead in the eye and she says, "Albert, you're the richest man that I know." She wasn't talking about money in my pocket. She wasn't talking about the house that I live in. She wasn't talking about the truck that I drive. She was talking about you people. She was talking about the power greater than myself. That if my feet keep moving on a daily basis, I can access any time, any place. Powerlessness? Hell no. I'm not even close to being powerless as I stand here before you. Not even close. I'm connected to something so far more powerful than the disease and the malady that I suffer from. Not even close to being powerless. Not even close. But it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. If we do, we are headed for trouble. We're not cured. What I have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. I thank everyone here for the opportunity to be of service. Ultimately, I thank the Great Spirit that allowed me to get here and allows me to be free. As long as I'm willing to work with his children. Thank you very much.